Dozens of ships were still scattered across the landing field, all of different makes and models, mostly small or of unusual pedigree. The larger vessels had been commandeered by Sith invaders, and when Reizu vanished, no like ships had ever come to replace them. They saw the shapes as they escaped the Crow. Never directly. They appeared from angles and disappeared the second one turned toward them. A man in mechanics gear crouched over a toolkit below the cruiser to their left. A large-eyed face looked darkly out of a neighboring cockpit. A collection of pilgrims in yellow robes huddled around one another as they glanced nervously toward the ward they could no longer safely travel to. More figures everywhere they turned, there in one breath and gone in the next. Chia snorted. Her eyes had been on the horizon where the sun sat nestled between two peaks. She turned to the rest of them and nodded toward it. The witch stopped far more than seems possible. It hasn't moved. It never does, said the traveler. They regarded the mountains with an odd tranquility. Well, that's all tremendously creepy, said Ikea. B-556 churred a scold at her knees. The droid had been sluggish since the unkind landing. An assessment was in order. Sure, miraculous, whatever, said Ikea to B-5. I want to know what we're eating tonight, let alone where we're sleeping. Then I want to know... She broke off and crossed her arms against the chill. What are we doing? What you came here to do, I presume, said Kuoru. Her voice was familiar and not. The sound correct, the cadence all wrong. She stepped forward from the group toward the pilgrim's ward, and it seemed as though she left her shadow behind. When she looked over her shoulder, she had no care for any of them but the Ronin. You're here to kill me, of course. The Ronin didn't move, though every part of him wanted to. He knew what danger he faced, and he knew he would do better to keep his stillness and reserve his strength. The being facing him wasn't Kuoru, because Kuoru no longer thought him worth killing, and the eyes fixed on him now fully desired his death. Wrong. Something of this rang foul, discrepant. Something he could not name. For of course it was wrong to see a soul he knew made other than what it was. So many times he had seen the witch turn the recently dead upon their allies and to stunning effect. Betrayal bought victory more swiftly than any blade. Perhaps it was only that this was the first time she had turned her work on him. But no, some other wrongness haunted him. She, the witch, was not as he remembered. He couldn't justify this suspicion, no more than he could banish it. It had grown from a kernel this past hour, ever since the Kyber Shard consumed him with its vision upon visions. The witch he met within that storm was one he had known in the resonant core of himself, the part of his being that echoed again in hers. The witch standing before him here, who wore Kuoru as a cloak and urged him to meet her with his blade drawn. He knew her, too, from her whispers, but... She smiled, a challenge that made an unsettling curve on Kuoru's sullen mouth. I won't make it easy, she said. She didn't imagine he doubted her. I couldn't now, could I? I need you to prove you're worth my effort. She... The witch, if he could still call her that, pointed toward the pilgrim's ward and passed it with Koru's muscled arm. I'm waiting there, where you left me, past the ward and the chasm. You'll walk the true pilgrim's path, and if you reach the end, then we'll meet again.
And if I don't? He had to ask.
She frowned at him, as if it hadn't occurred to her that he wouldn't.
You'll want to... And with all speed, unless you'd rather Reizu take you too.
Then she was gone, as suddenly as she had arrived. Kuoru sagged without the witch to hold her up, and the Ronin knelt by her. He didn't believe he could have remained standing if he hadn't.
Chapter 36.
What exactly did she mean by taken by Reizu?
Chia asked Fox in the immediate aftermath. Her interest seemed practically academic. Fox had been as transfixed as the rest of them when the witch sashayed past them wearing her koru skin. They'd been stuck with a face Akia wanted to call constipated because she was afraid it was really anguished. Now they pretended they'd never known an emotion more intense than miffed and smiled ruefully.
I'm not entirely sure, but I know I didn't come here alone the first time, and I think that changed quite quickly.
Akia groaned. All right, how are we getting Grimm up the mountain? Fortunately, it wasn't a debate. Even Koru just nodded once she stood of her own free will, hand pressed to her forehead and a familiar scowl carved into her face. The time for quibbles had apparently passed when Grimm pulled his absolute force garbage nonsense and dumped them on... Akia could barely think it. Reizu. Real under her feet, but her mind wouldn't catch. She knew the Yojo skyline better from Imperial propaganda posters than from her own memory. The lost history, Reizu. Oh, how it had pained the Empire to be deprived of that precious jewel. Akia had been born in a southern district nearer to rice fields than to the Pilgrim's Ward. She'd never even seen Shinsui Temple until she and the other drafted kids were flying over it as they were shipped out. It made the next hour feel that much more vague and strange. She had mechanical purpose and was grateful for that, especially after Chia asked her the best route by which to get Grimm from the landing field to the chasm, and she had to shrug. Luckily, Fox still had a mental map of Pilgrim's Ward, but it stung Akia to admit how little she knew about her own home. Instead, she directed the apprentices to the crow's food stores and emergency travel satchels. She always had both in case she picked up somebody in dire need of some kind of supply, and argued with Grimm over how to move B-556. His processors are on the fritz, Akia said, and his ventilation is barely doing its job. You make him come with us, and he'll burn up before we're even over the first bridge.
He's coming, Grimm insisted.
You'll break him, Akia insisted right back. B-5 blatted unhelpfully. You don't feel fine, she snapped. You're lucky you made it this far. We push you any further, and you're going to be a glorified bucket in a hat. At that point, Chia pulled Akia away, ostensibly to help her rewire a defunct speeder some of the kids had found on the other side of a nearby tourist transport. Akia kept muttering as she was herded. I'm right, aren't I? Whatever was done to this place just up and ruins anything more technologically complex than a chronometer. That was what downed the crow. That's what's wrong with B. We can't drag him any further into this mess or he'll...
I suspect you aren't wrong, said Chia. Otherwise, we would have seen one or two curious droids by now.
But they hadn't. They were as absent as the people.
I doubt our little friend has missed that, Chia went on. He's still set on accompanying us, so I think we should let him. He'd rather burn out with us than alone. I expect he wishes to be useful before he does.
Bleak.
Chia nodded to concede the point. Akia sighed and didn't harp. She wanted to be kind. To B-5 and to everybody a little bit. Even Grimm. At least for now. Especially as Grimm put in the effort to apologize. When she brought the speeder back over and gave him her estimate for how long it had, by which she obliquely meant to imply B-5 had about as long and no longer, he surprised her by handing over the puzzle box.
Yours are still in it, she said dumbly.
The glinting red splinters were intermingled with all the others.
They're better off in your keeping, he said,
then paused and seemed regretful.
If you'd rather not pray for them, leave them where you will.
She clutched the whole thing to her chest and tucked it away in her coat. I'm not that rude. She decided then that she could be mad at him later, when she had the time to be. When she didn't have to worry about what the witch might be trying to do to them for the crime of intruding on her sanctuary. The apprentices had some ideas about that.
Look, there's another!
One of them whispered to his friend. It doesn't make sense. It has to be an illusion.
They had crossed the bridge into the Pilgrim's Ward by then. The speeder whirred unpleasantly as it went. For as long as it worked, it carried Chia in the front. Fox's nervous cat crouched by her feet in the footwell, with Grim and B5 in the back. Everybody else moved around it on foot. They tried to get Koru into the speeder too, until she about bit Fox's hand straight off. Now the Sith demon trailed at their rear, sharp eyes flicking every which way, the ornate hilt that belonged to Fox's dead Jedi master gripped tight at her side. She looked frankly disgusted to take the lightsaber, and Fox had looked all too ready to be rid of it, but none of them could be choosy about their gear in the face of whatever the hell Reizu had in store. Case in point, the thing they all found themselves staring at on the other side of the river, awaiting them in the Pilgrim's Ward. A cloud deer, or what looked like one. Long in the leg and neck, white-flecked fur, a variegated purple-gray, and horns that branched in beautiful filigree patterns over its head. It stood at the lip of an alley in the Pilgrim's Ward and stared at them, unblinking, with a wet, black eye. Another trotted up behind it, ears twitching with curiosity. Akia remembered the cloud deer. They had lived in the hundreds on the grounds of one of Reizu's largest and oldest shrines. It was located in the northern stretch of the Pilgrim's Ward. Their party was coming from the southwest. More and more cloud deer wandered across their path the farther they pressed down dusty avenues. There were other signs of intermittent life as well. Sprawling vined plants cracking up through alleyways to unfold into the streets, threatening to trip them up at every turn. Nests built inside open-doored shops and clutches of brilliantly colored little songbirds that followed them from corner to corner, unafraid of the interlopers. One of the apprentices lured an intrepid yellow nub of a bird into their hands in exchange for a thumb of rice.
"See, they're domesticated," the apprentice said to their peers.
"Or it was born after all the people got flattened."
They were still seeing the here and gone again shades. Now they also passed the occasional slumped figure of a defunct droid.
"It still doesn't make sense," one of the apprentices insisted. "She's stopped people, but not animals. Stopped the sun."
"She hasn't stopped the sun. She stopped the planet."
"No, she can't have done that either, because if she had, then gravity..."
"Stop trying to make sense of it. It's the Force."
"Don't it's the Force me."
Akia yearned to complain with them, but they swallowed their bickering the second any adult trailed too close. Fox sensed her agony. They beckoned her toward the front of their little contingent. Two apprentices passed her as she jogged up. Fox was sending all six out in varying pairs to search storefronts whenever they spotted a likely apothecary or grocer. Whatever the kids scrounged got dumped in the speeder's front seat next to Chia for the cat to guard. Medkits and rations, a collection of components for Grim, and so forth. In the back, Grim had B5's chassis open, presumably so he could be neurotic about it. Could she call him that? There he hunched, Dark Lord of Dark Lords, vainly trying to convince a droid that his circuitry wasn't mysteriously sputtering to death. But what else did she want him doing right now? The man was half dead. Unless they tripped over a portable vat of Bacta to dump him into, there'd be no improvement to his lungs before they got him to Shinsui. Akia signaled Yuahiro before he dashed off and told him to look for some kind of face guard, something that would fit over that respirator. Yuahiro looked altogether far too pleased to be trusted. Somewhere he'd picked up a kitchen knife. It wasn't that Akia didn't want him armed, she just didn't like to see it. Fox had an odd look when Akia drew up next to them. Amazed that she still cared enough to look out for Grim? Maybe. In her defense, it just made sense. She didn't want to die, and who else could they hope to pit against the witch? "How are you?" they asked. Akia's mouth fell open. "What? Why?" "I'm... weird, obviously." "You're home. I imagine it's a lot." It was a lot for them to ask. A dozen awful feelings converged in her all at once.
Akia stared up at Fox in bewildered upset until she turned away with a purpose. They had reached an intersection of two streets between the dark wooden structures of the Pilgrim's Ward. At the end of one street stood the rhymed gray walls of a shrine complex. At the end of the other, a square opened up, lined with long-abandoned stalls and colored banners. Each way she looked, she for an instant saw one shade, yawning, or another, running. She recognized none of it. Or she did and she didn't. She could call the colors familiar, and the smells, sort of. Everything she remembered sat too near or too far from her mind, abstracted by a warped layer of nostalgia and alienation. It wasn't just that she hadn't grown up this far into the city, let alone in the Pilgrim's Ward, nor was it that Imperial Edict had stripped the ward of the metal and grime of life as anyone truly lived it. It wasn't even that the buildings were here and the people weren't. History absent texture, or that the natural world underlying that history had seen fit to burst through tenderly preserved structures without any kind of regard for what the Empire thought beautiful and worthy of preserving. It was maybe a little that she'd spent 20 years stomping around the rest of the galaxy dreaming of Reizu because it was gone. Just gone. A fantasy she changed with every recollection. And to be faced with its tangibility, no matter how warped by aforementioned absolute force garbage nonsense, was to confront a gap between memory and reality. She remembered a Reizu, not this one. It was, on top of all this, that to be here meant they weren't there. The world where a rent-open Imperial dreadnought over Dekian meant princes declaring it time to put aside every pretension of peace in favor of sending their Jedi to cut one another open, to say nothing of the pitiful souls who would inevitably get in the way. And it was that she wouldn't have been here at all, walking these paths and passing these shrines and shadows on her way to sending her own ghosts where they belonged, if not for Fox and Grimm, if she hadn't helped them. She had what she wanted. The price hadn't even been hers to pay. By any measure, it was worth it, even if she couldn't feel that it was. Fox had the audacity to look sad for once. A small expression, because for them, honest meant slight. As she fiercely missed their mask, they laid a hand on her shoulder, all sympathy. "Thanks," she squawked, and fell back as far as she could without making a problem of herself. It hurt, was the thing. To see Fox walk these streets like they knew them. It made her feel all the more unreal. Akia ended up dragging her heels by Koru, who grew wary at her approach, but eased ever so slightly when Akia neglected to engage her in anything resembling conversation. Koru eyed their surroundings with a suspicion Akia appreciated. She didn't expect familiarity, just problems. And she clearly wanted very badly for there to be some variety of problem. The Pilgrim's Ward insisted on disappointing her. Every time they passed another alley empty of anything but those spectral shades, Koru wound a little tighter. Akia nearly wanted to pat her shoulder. It had felt too awful when Fox patted hers to really entertain the impulse. A few hours in, by Chia's guess, as every one of their chronometers disagreed with the others, the speeder stopped working in the middle of a square a few orderly blocks from the chasm end of the Pilgrim's Ward. That meant figuring what they could afford to carry and what to abandon, and also arguing with Grimm about B5. Akia didn't want anything to do with any of that, so she stuck with Koru on patrol. Koru gave her a long side-eye about it, but lacked the patience to ask. They paused at a corner of the square from where they could see Shinsui. The temple complex was from this angle obscured by the trees on the mountainside across the chasm. Its roofs, laden with snow, blazed in the unmoving rays of the unsetting sun. Koru glared at it like she thought it would flinch. Abruptly, she looked elsewhere, down the street they were standing on the lip of. The angle of the sun meant the entire street was cast in shadow. Bordered by two straight-edge wooden structures, it sloped upward at its end until it became stone steps lined with snow-bitten foliage. A figure stood on the steps, darkly clothed. Koru couldn't tear her eyes away. Neither could Akia. It looked like any other one of the shades, but still she stared, breath held. It vanished. Akia swallowed her breath. Of course it poofed, she told herself. The shades didn't stick. They popped in and out of existence at even the slightest movement. She'd shifted her gaze just so, or inhaled too deeply, or... Then she could see it again. This time, the figure stood at the bottom of the stone stairs. Akia cursed and grabbed at Koru's arm. Koru wouldn't move. Not like a statue wouldn't move, but like the rock over a volcanic fissure was horribly still until it burst. And because she couldn't go, neither could Akia. She just stood there, fear winding up from her soles into her skull as the figure advanced. Down the slope, onto the street, closer. It flickered into view just before a break between the structures lining the street where gold twilight streamed through. The next time the shade appeared, they'd be fully illuminated, and their shadow would stretch long as a sword. Koru's foot slid back, and Akia jerked again at her arm. Hey, no, come on, she whispered urgently, telling herself all the while that she needed to shout, get help, because why else were they traveling in a group if not to make sure they didn't have to face this kind of terror alone? Koru, come on! Koru growled and threw her off. There was a fury in her face that made Akia back up a startled step. Instinct had her hand at her waist, on the blaster she hated using but always carried, because a kid didn't cut her teeth on assassinating a Sith warrior without learning how to defend herself. They were caught like that, staring hard at each other. Seconds passed, stretching into a minute. The street remained empty, but for the two of them, the figure did not appear again. Akia didn't know what to call the look on Koru's face the moment she realized the shade wasn't coming back. All twisted up with anger, and also, Akia thought with dawning sympathy, loss. Sorry, she said. Guess I spooked it. You did no such thing, Koru spat. That was no ordinary shade. It was a warrior. A Sith. What gave it away? The melodramatic flouncing around the shadows? Koru's white-knuckled hands gripped the dead lord's lightsaber like a bone she wanted to break. It was a vessel of the witch. A demon. Past the bluster and snarl, Akia heard a tremor of fear. It made her feel a terrible heel. She allowed Koru the grace of silence for a minute as she contacted Chia to warn her to keep an eye out for any shades that proved particularly persistent or that, much more problematically, started to move. The whole time, Koru's gaze remained fixed on the stairs and the street. Akia should have focused on the same things. They needed to stay on guard until the rest of the crew was ready to move out. Instead, Akia kept glancing at Koru. The rigidity of her attention, and the fragility. She thought, don't say anything. Her mouth, forever a chump for the hurt and mad about it, declined to obey. So, said Akia, you clearly didn't love getting puppeted around like that back on the landing field. I'm guessing you don't want to talk about it. The very suggestion gave Koru a look of true horror. Akia raised her hands. I get it. I know you think Grimm's the worst. I don't think you're definitely wrong about him either, but I'm also sure that the witch doesn't feel like the best alternative. So I guess I'm saying, sorry. It's awful. Koru stared down at the empty street as if she wanted the shade to return. It made Akia drop her hand back to the blaster at her waist, just in case. I saw the witch's work once before, said Koru. When the Sith gathered here for the Great Muster. The invasion, thought Akia, though she didn't say it. Koru also paused, mouth twisted with conflict. It probably shamed her to feel anything that complicated her anger.
"We fought," she said at last. "We bled. Died. And she raised us up. Our fellows once more beside us. Enemies turned to allies. I was breathless, invigorated, all awe and delight. Hope."
She looked up toward the chasm in the temple, both now hidden by buildings.
"When they had served their purpose, she released them. We prayed to speed them on."
Then she was looking at her hands, like she couldn't understand that they were indeed hers.
"And I am not serving the purpose she set for me."
The unspoken conundrum. If the witch had raised Koru to kill Grimm, and Koru had failed to do so, then why did she still have any hands to speak of? Why was she not once more dead and formless, a memory in the cosmic unquantity of the Force? Akia had nothing like an answer. She knew what happened to her people's ghosts. She only half understood what the Jedi did with theirs. She had not the faintest idea what stories Koru's people told about their own dead. She had no comfort to offer, let alone answers. Then again, no one had answers except for the witch, and the witch didn't seem likely to help anyone but herself anytime soon.
"All right," Akia said. "Well, you're still here. So maybe that means you being here has less to do with what she wants than you thought it did."
"Don't be a fool. I died. She returned me by her will. I am her creature." Koru grimaced at the stone steps. They remained empty, inviting. "I am evidently her creature still."
"Are you? She got you when we landed, sure. But she's not wearing you now."
"Is she not?
Don't play mind games with yourself. You're never going to win."
Koru finally looked away toward the square, where the rest of their shabby crew had finally emptied the speeder of everything worth carrying. Akia was compelled to turn her attention back to the steps. Out of the corner of her eye, a shade flickered in a door halfway down the street. She held her breath. It didn't move.
"I don't know why I'm helping you," said Koru.
"Do you want to?" Koru bared her teeth like a pouting dog. Akia rubbed the back of her own neck.
"Sorry, wrong question. Too big. I barely know what I want, and we're stomping all over the biggest wand I've ever had. I got home."
She put her hand to her side where she tucked away the puzzle box full of the ghosts that belonged both to her and to other people.
"But I can't stop thinking, why am I here? I thought I was coming for other people. I didn't think I cared for my sake, but I do. I must. Because when I got off the Crow and I saw Reizu, I felt nothing. And I hated that."
"What do you feel now?" It seemed very important to Koru to know, so Akia thought hard before she answered. She didn't have the time she would have wanted. The comlink on her wrist blinked, Chia's signal to join back up. So, as they ducked out of the alley and into the light of the square, she said all she could think to say.
"I feel like I'm not done yet. I never feel done. Is that my problem?"
Koru seemed to want to scowl, but her face wouldn't let her get that mean. When she spoke, it was a bit like she thought Akia couldn't hear her, though she wasn't truly quiet, just distracted.
"You said you want to be more than one thing. The you I've known has always wanted things outside herself. Perhaps you should identify what you want within yourself as well."
Akia put her hands together in mock prayer.
"How very Jedi of you. Hold your tongue or I'll eat it."
"Oh my." Koru didn't smile, but she scoffed. And Akia laughed because she thought maybe that she deserved to. In any case, she doubted they'd get many more chances, and if she had to name her own wants, laughing was probably one of them.
Chapter 37.
Their pace slowed considerably as they neared the chasm. The old man wouldn't leave his droid, and said droid was badly waning. Soon enough, B-556 would go the way of the speeder. Koru found her hand on the Lord's lightsaber, thinking of severing B-5's legs, but the shadows grew thicker the closer they drew to the park at the north end of the Pilgrim's Ward, and she concluded it would be better for all of them if the droid could shoot at least one demon before he expired. At last, only a frosted park separated them from the chasm edge. Pairs of cloud deer watched their advance from between fruit trees rendered barren black by cold. The inanimate shades had lessened. By the day the witch took Reizu, the Sith had already banned any pilgrims from the path to Shinsui Temple, so there had been no people to leave behind their vestiges. Only the Sith remained, and they came swiftly and from wicked angles. They appeared in bursts of black current, spliced with white flare that cut so violently into the world they felt like a wound even before they had severed flesh. Koru met the first head-on. Their party had chosen to take the wide, pale path of gravel and sand that led through the park to the first bridge. The demon whirled out from behind the thick trunk of a tree that sheltered the way. They were as shadowed and fast as the one Koru had seen just an hour before, and in their hands was a long, thick staff, at the head of which a bright red blade shone sharply. They swung for the old man's head. Koru's heart caught in her throat as she, white flare lining every fiber of her musculature, threw herself past him and tackled the demon to the ground, blue-white blade jabbing into the demon's midsection. The demon dissipated before they hit the frozen dirt, so Koru tumbled over root-riddled ground alone. She sprang back to her feet as the demon once more manifested. It hurtled past her, back toward the path. The old man was ready by then. He had armed himself when they left the speeder. His lightsaber, recovered from her on the Crow, had been hung at his waist beside that ancient blaster. Koru suspected the latter would be more useful as a bludgeoning device under Reizu's strange strictures, but his lightsaber thrummed redly as he awaited the demon. He struck clean through the shade, and it melted into the air like ashen cobwebs. Not even its weapon remained. The old man's blade reflected in the blackened lacquer of the half-mask that guarded his face, a proper Sith piece of armor, its molded scowl long-toothed and fearsome. It looked much like the one he had cut off Koru's jaw not so long ago. He met her eyes over it and nodded. Her lip curled and she didn't linger. She hadn't done it for him. That was the last moment of calm. From then, the Sith demons emerged from every dark corner and all was chaos, cunning, and blood. Koru spun around a demon with two fiery short swords and plunged her blue blade into his back. He convulsed and vanished soundlessly. It hurt to see him disperse. Even as she slashed and skewered, she dreamed of fighting with, not against, these echoes. She coveted their red radiance. But they belonged to the witch, and every one of their stolen kyber blades was an artifact of the old man's power. She hated both witch and traitor lord, she told herself, and the hate was tidally uncomplicated. The shades nevertheless harrowed her heart. She wished them free unto themselves, just as she wished herself her own again, what self she still had left. Every hesitation had a price. Another demon emerged from the lee of a twisted old cherry tree and surged past, near through her. Koru was at the last second shoved aside by one of the apprentices, the one who looked after the others, Yuehiro. The boy grunted, and the sweetness of burnt flesh tickled Koru's nose. Fury shot through her, hot and blinding. She lunged toward the demon. It escaped her thrust and made a beeline for the old man. He was already engaged with another figure, their red blades snarling against each other. An ambush. Koru saw in flashes at the corner of her eyes, Fox throwing another demon aside, B5 firing two quick shots, Akia... No. Focus. She didn't control the battlefield and couldn't hope to. Even had she been keener to the subtleties of presence, the Sith demons were too brief and unstable to properly track. Her only chance to strike lay in the moments they dared to appear. The one she chased vanished when it was still out of sword's reach from the old man. Koru thought, quick. If you were to kill him, what angle would you pick? The old man halved the demon he had been dueling and staggered. His shoulders heaved, and he planted his feet to right himself. Before his bent form, Koru's target bloomed darkly, its blade already raised overhead to cut him to the ground. Koru was the white flare itself as she cleaved it cleanly from head to sacrum. It dissolved into nothing so close to her mouth that she felt as though she inhaled its leavings. She was left staring at the old man and his hard breathing, his sallow cheeks. He nodded at her again, but this time his gaze dropped as he braced himself on his knees. An unexpected fear gripped her to see him so frail. They hadn't even made it to the bridges. A pained grunt drew her attention back around. It had come from Yuihiro, who was now crouched on the ground. A black burn cut deep into the boy's left arm just below his shoulder. He cradled the arm to his side, but it hung limp in his grip. "What were you thinking?" Koru demanded as she stormed toward him. Yuihiro squared his jaw and shook his head. There was no apology in his eye. Koru was taken aback by a jolt of recognition. There had been a time, she was certain, when she too had shoved her way forward into danger, when she should have let a more experienced warrior take a blow they'd earned. She had, at least, possessed the sense not to be nearly dismembered. So Koru felt no compunctions, none at all, about snarling into the boy's face. "I didn't save your life to see you waste it." Yuihiro swallowed hard and looked away. Chia clucked as she swept between them. She handed her cane to Koru and knelt to inspect Yuihiro. "It's hardly the children's fault that they went from nearly dying on an Imperial dreadnought to nearly dying on Reizu. They're doing quite well."
"They are, for the circumstances, but perhaps not well enough," said Fox. Their cat was on their heels, tail lashing and ears turned back as it eyed every passing shadow. "I suspect it's time we consider parting ways."
Koru rounded on Fox and jerked her head at another of the apprentices who was laid out on the ground, clutching her stomach, with two of her fellows leaning over her.
"You'd leave them to die?"
"The opposite, I hope. You've noticed by now that our intrusive friends have a rather singular interest, yes?"
They inclined their head toward the old man. He was crouched by B5, Akia beside them. A wisp of thin smoke curled through the little droid's hat.
"They target him, first and foremost. The rest of us are but obstacles, so step kindly out of the way and be kindly left alone."
"They're Sith," Koru countered. "They think. Leave what you value behind, and they'll find a way to make it your weakness."
"They're shades, barely present. If they were still as cunning as you fear, I believe we would be dead by now."
Koru's argument stuck in her throat. She agreed in terms of pure instinct, though it stung to do so. Fox drew closer, their feet crunching on frosted ground.
"We've come this far only because we did so together," they said, so very considerately soft. "They've given of themselves to ensure it. They have nothing left to offer but their lives."
"Let them pay what they will," said Koru,
though as she said it, she wished it back in her mouth. She turned away toward Yuihiro, who was stoically determined as Chia bound his arm to his body.
"They don't want to stay," she said shortly. "They won't."
"Like hell they won't."
Akia joined them, arms crossed so her hands were entrenched in the folds of her coat. Her furtive eyes flicked from Fox to Koru.
"B's down for the count. You could drag him, I guess, but you might as well break your own ankles and save yourself the trouble." "You make it sound like you're not coming," said Fox.
Koru eyed Akia sharply. She was thinking the same thing. The children she could feasibly justify leaving behind. They were injured and amateurs and too determined to help.
But Akia... Well, I'm not, said Akia, as she retrieved something from the folds of her coat and shoved it into Koru's hands. It took Koru a moment to understand what she now held. It scintillated against her skin, so she knew it as keenly as she knew heat or pain. But she couldn't begin to explain why Akia would have given it to anyone, let alone to her. The small box of Kyber shards hung heavy in her hands. The old man's prizes, alongside Akia's own treasured ghost hoard. She looked up from it to Akia, who met her with an expression both flustered and defiant, then bowed.
Please.
Why? Koru asked, because she couldn't yet accept that it had happened. She wanted badly for Akia to realize she had made a mistake, because she couldn't fathom what she was meant to do with this gift.
I know where I'm useful, and it's not wrestling with undead Sith.
Akia nodded over her shoulder toward the apprentices. Them? I can manage. Teen's a teen, whether they can invert your brain or no. And they're good kids. And they're hurt. Koru couldn't bring herself to put the Kyber away. She tried to catch Akia's eye again, but the woman remained stubbornly evasive, bending over to scoop up Fox's cat, which had sensed Fox's intent to leave it behind and begun to whine.
This isn't what you want, Koru said. You said you came here to put them where they belonged, not to give them up.
Akia lightly kicked Koru's heel.
You told me I had to want something for myself, not outside myself.
Okay, I want help. Do this for me.
You trust me.
Why not? You're stubborn as they come. And you like me.
And I asked.
Please. Koru slid the box inside her cloak, half expecting as she did that it would be taken back. But Akia's hands remained wrapped around the cat, and Fox's were occupied with soothing the idiot creature. Koru was permitted to stow it away, and in the end, all she could say was,
I don't know your prayers.
Akia clucked her tongue.
I'm not asking you to pray.
No. She was asking Koru to be her prayer. Carry my ghosts, she said, and bring them where they're meant to be. Do it for me, because I have faith that you can.
Ludicrous.
And yet, Koru wanted to do it. It would be a gift, she realized, to have a reason to go forward that was neither the witch nor the old man. Let them try and stop her.
Chapter 38.
They left the apprentices and B-556 with Chia, Akia, and the cat at an overlook from where they could see the first bridge. B-5 could no longer move independently, but his internal comlink still functioned well enough that the old man's wrist cuff blinked now and again. The old man told the droid to look out for the others. B-5 told him that he intended to pray. A day ago, it might have annoyed Koru to hear the droid say as much, but as she stepped out onto the bridge with the old man and Fox, she decided she would take Akia's lesson and accept any help she could get. The long bridge to the first shrine was made of ancient roots and branches, grown into intricately knotted rope. It creaked over a chasm that plunged into mist so thick and silent that they swallowed the cry of every darting bird within them. The first shrine stood atop a monumental column of weathered gray stone and rose 5 stories tall, an 8-ringed dark spire jutting from its peak. There was no path around it. Pilgrims were meant to pay respects at every altar on their way to Shinsui Temple. For all Koru did little of her own praying, she expected it would feel wrong to simply pass through. Each shrine houses the relic of a long-dead monk, or a Jedi, or an emperor, who knows, said Fox as they drew close. They're gods, and they're not. They reveal the entirety of the universe to be an elaborate pattern of infinitely succeeding elemental particles, or they reveal the folly of clinging to the wisdom of bodily knowledge when the only true path to divinity comes in transcending mean flesh and the obliteration that follows. They're quite holy, either way, and beautiful. Have you ever seen them before?
No, said Koru. The old man only nodded. He was inscrutable, other than for being tired. It had pained him to leave his droid, but he pushed on with the determined countenance of the dying. This Koru grudgingly understood. It was Fox who concerned her. They were so awed by the shrines, so enchanted by the chasm. All the things they didn't remember about their time on Raizu no longer seemed to bother them as they had on the Crow. Had they also forgotten their fear? It made Koru hold more tightly to every feeling that she could with any certainty call her own. A figure awaited them before the door to the first shrine, broad and tall. A demon. It stood as they neared. Fox swept their arm out and upward, and the black current knocked the demon off balance. The demon twisted to regain their bearing, but before they landed, Koru dived toward them, singeing with white flare. She stabbed her blue-white blade into the demon's shoulder and carved away an arm with momentum enough to send the body whirling past and behind her. They fell in the direction of the old man, and he cut them down in one swift strike. The demon's form bled blackly into the air, as had all the shades before them. Fox clapped their hands free of imaginary dust and ushered their comrades toward the shrine. It would have been easier if you used your blade, Koru muttered as she passed. Oh, let's not grow dependent on it. Master Ronin only had so much time to put it back together. And what happens if we have to dig out the shard again? Koru narrowed her eyes, unconvinced. Meanwhile, the old man frowned.
They've no need of it.
Koru scoffed. Regardless, they pressed on. Through the darkened pagoda and past the idol interred within, and onto the next woven bridge. The shrines were built in such a clever way that each successive pillar only became visible once the pilgrim had exited the shrine prior. As they stepped back into the permanent evening light, the second shrine loomed gloomily before them, enshrouded by mist. On the next bridge, Fox seemed about to start another story. Koru hissed them quiet and jerked her chin ahead.
Another demon awaited them on the steps of the second shrine. It had a companion, one who crouched upon the third tier of snow-covered eaves. Meanwhile, behind them, in the entryway of the first shrine, they saw a shadowed silhouette picking itself up off the ground, a silhouette that looked alarmingly like that of the demon they had just felled.
Well, either that one was hiding, or we have a bit more of a resurrection problem than we thought, said Fox. The old man cursed and looked agitatedly at his wrist cuff. There was a brief flurry of communication between him and B5. It seemed to cut off before he wanted it to.
They're rising up in the park as well, said the old man.
Koru cursed this time, and more savagely. We'll just have to pray they're all more interested in their old commander than in harassing the stragglers, said Fox. Either way, we ought to hurry. Koru bristled, but she couldn't argue. Forward was the only direction that would solve the matter. So long as the witch continued to resurrect her demons, there would be no safety on Reizu. It at least confirmed that the witch no longer played by her old rules. Koru was no exception. The witch did not relinquish the dead she wielded. Until they dealt with her, Koru would never be free.
They met the two demons waiting at the second shrine before the one from the first could catch up to them. The numbers still lay in their favor, but the old man was already flagging. He staggered once, nearly caught by a strike, and was saved only by Fox yanking him back with the black current. Koru swept past both and threw the demon against a painted wall with a burst of white flare. She followed with a kick, her heel digging into their side and sending them to the ground where she drove her blade into their head. Just as she did, the demon used the last of their strength to thrust their blade toward her like a spear. She twisted away, but it bit hungrily into her side. The demon evaporated beneath her, her wound the only evidence it had ever existed. Yet when Koru lifted her hand away from her ribs, they were unmarred.
Well, that's certainly an advantage,
said Fox as they came up the steps. The old man trailed behind them, hand pressed to his own still-wounded side.
Were you doing that before?
Koru's brow creased, and her head ached strangely as she tried to recall. She was near certain that since her death she had been hurt here and there, at Seikara when Akia had blackened her eye, and on the Reverend when she burned her hands, and elsewhere when she...
I didn't feel it then, she said.
Fox glanced behind them. The demon from the first shrine was midway down the bridge and fast advancing, revived, repaired, and strong as ever.
Just like Koru.
I suppose there's something to be said for learning from example, though I think we ought not to learn from yours.
Koru's brow remained furrowed as they hurried through the shrine. Fox's words stank. She didn't know what of. Perhaps it was that they were uninjured as well. But then they were far more skilled at unseating their opponents at range.
She shook her head. If something needed to be done about Fox, the old man would know it before she did.
That was, if she could trust the old man to deploy his mercilessness on Fox.
He was undeniably weak when it came to them, hobbled by an affection, a dependence.
She couldn't let her eye wander too far from either of them. She had her own self to mind as well, though the witch had been silent since the Reverend, outside of when she stole Koru's body wholesale. A whisper had begun to lick Koru's ear every now and then. She refused to entertain it. The witch would not have her again, if she could help it. They progressed as quickly as they were able, which was nerve-wrackingly not quick at all. The old man continued to decline. Fox spent nearly as much time lugging him forward as they did fending off their foes. Much of the violence was left to Koru. She didn't mind. She couldn't. Violence had always been a natural end for her. And moreover, the witch's power allowed her to fight fearlessly, sure she would emerge unscathed. Even so, they needed the old man to reach the temple alive, and with every encounter, they lost ground. They couldn't afford to meet more than the one or two demons they faced at each shrine, or the three they found at the fifth, the last of whom speared Koru through the middle before the old man threw it bodily off the pillar. It took him a painful half minute to regain his breath after that, and she lifted him upright.
You're being reckless, he rasped. You're jealous, she countered, then caught herself and glowered.
She didn't want his care, but reluctantly, she understood it. It came from his guilt, which he deserved, not least of all for the ills he'd done to her twice over. She by no means admired what he had become, yet something in her wanted to hold on to the man she remembered knowing of before. The rebel, the commander, the lord. That was certainly not the man Fox had to near drag along as they made their way across the bridge for the sixth shrine.
Tell me, Koru, they said, how many do we have picking themselves up on the fifth?
She strained her eyes to see and could only report two.
Then we're lucky. They rise where they fall. We should have been punting them off the sides this whole time.
The demons in the sixth shrine seemed to know their scheme. They dodged and lunged with uncanny awareness of the precipitous cliffs. They had been warned, either by what they saw when their prey passed through the fifth shrine, or by the witch's whispers in their own ears. Koru nearly lost an arm, ridding herself of the last.
Send him forward,
she grunted as she joined Fox and the old man on the misty stretch to the final shrine.
Fast as you can through the seventh, then to the temple. We cover and we cut the bridge once he's made it.
The old man balked.
We'll catch up, Fox assured him. We can't leave you without caregivers, can we?
To Koru they added, speaking of, let's let as many of them get on the bridge as possible, send all we can into the abyss. Ensures they'll have to find another way across unless they'd like to spend a lot of time climbing, and then, well, more of a buffer.
Koru nodded tentatively.
She didn't hate the plan, especially as it was her own. But realizing it would leave her standing side by side with Fox's uncanny calm unnerved her from skin to bone. The last bridge was as beautiful as the others, intricately grown and hung with lanterns. Koru noticed its beauty because they planned to destroy it. As they waited on its slats while the old man staggered to the temple cliffs, Fox maintained an elegantly straight posture. They still hadn't touched their blade. Koru felt mad for thinking something wrong, but it was. The Jedi clans boasted of their warriors' serenity in the face of peril because the Jedi were all too comfortable with their power. Koru had suffered from the same myopia for well over a decade when she had been the worst violence in her little world. Now she was all tension and fear. It didn't matter that her body would recover from injury, or that her every pain was but temporary. She was, with every iota of her being, determined to send these demons to the faraway depths, yes. But after them, she had the interminable witch to reckon with. And she, great Wraith, she loomed. Fox didn't care. Koru had seen them swallow fear, and she had seen it make them cavalier and cruel. This was something else. Something defined as much by the gaps eaten into their mind as by their wholly unmarred flesh. When the first demons appeared on the eaves of the seventh shrine, Koru could no longer hold it in. "Whatever's going on with you," she bit out, "you need to get it together." "Is that a smidge of concern I hear? I'm touched." "It's a damn heap of concern. You're a liability." "No more so than you." Koru balked. She suspected the witch still murmured to Fox from the hollow spaces in their head that she had carved into them. She had done the same to Koru, was still trying to do so even now. But Fox had never admitted to hearing any such whispers. It made Koru afraid that they didn't realize the whispers were there. Her strange look had made Fox pause, and they lifted a hand to their mouth as if their own words were foreign to them. They were so struck by her stare that when the first demon stepped onto the bridge, Koru dashed forward to meet them alone. It wasn't until she was pressed back to where Fox still stood and diverted a slash meant for their neck that they startled back to themselves. They inhaled sharply and at last leaned into the fray. Yet as they did, the black current, as ever their sole weapon, the whisper in Koru's ear sharpened.
"Careful,"
it said.
"Careful, careful."
She was no fool. Of course she was careful. But why would the witch warn her of her own creature? "Koru," Fox said as they retreated together toward the temple, luring their foes farther onto the bridge. "Have you sorted out what it is you're here for?" They didn't mean here on Reizu or on this warpath. They meant her very being. The answer to the questions they had posed not so long ago. Who was she? Who for? Akia's ghost horde weighed heavily in Koru's cloak. The Jedi Lord's lightsaber sat perfect and unclean in her grip. The witch loomed darkly beneath her feet and at her back, hungry for the traitor Koru shepherded toward her. Her answer was none of these. It was something else and other, something more. She hadn't yet captured it on her tongue, but... "I'm close. Have you? Were you right? Did they mean to fix their mistakes?" "Yes." They said it so quickly, yet a cloud had gathered behind their eyes. Koru's heart was wary, but she felt at the same time an unexpected pang of sympathy. "Then tell me," she pushed. "Who are you? And why?" They had reached the end of the bridge. The witch's demons neared, and they had such little time, but Koru insisted. Fox's gaze had glazed with distance. They wanted to answer her in good faith, she thought. In a way, they did. A winter white flash of light and shriek of sound, and the bridge gave way under Koru's feet. Fox had done the severing, so they'd known just when to leap back. They landed on the rocky cliffside as Koru threw herself toward it, falling, grasping blindly for purchase. She found it where she couldn't have anticipated. A hand latched around her forearm and gripped her with feverish need. The same fingers that had just cut the bridge out from under her dug desperate bruises into her arm. Fox's face was stricken with a dazed understanding, a horror. Koru dug the same bruises into their flesh, teeth gritted, eyes bright. If they knew they weren't alone in their own mind, then they could fight. It was what she had done, and she'd done it at their behest. If they could together wrench freedom from the witch...
Let go.
Koru's nails bit into Fox's arm. Their teeth clenched, but they held on. Yes, that was what they needed. The need for self and outside of self.
Let go. Let go. Let go.
Koru gasped, and it hurt to do so. Breath didn't belong in her deadness, and she was only shadowing life, but she would cling because...
Let go.
Koru refused to listen. It didn't matter. Fox did. Their grip slackened. Koru's arm slid between their fingers, and then she was free. She fell. They had let go. As she plunged, the wind screaming in her ears, she stared up at the vanishing white figure and thought, "They could still catch me." Then Koru didn't see them at all. Only the white upon white of a devouring mist. And she was at last alone.
Chapter 39.
The Ronin saw the bridge fall from the distance of the stone steps that led to Shinsui Temple. He had collapsed upon them, one hand clutched to his aching side, the other balanced so he could check his wrist cuff for any sign of light. It was still dark as the bridge tumbled into the mist, graceful as a broken spider web, loosing small black shapes as it tore. For long minutes after, he was alone. When he wasn't, only the traveler returned. They held their arm in front of them, as if it had been injured, the sleeve fallen away to show an unmarred stretch of flesh from wrist to elbow. Once close enough to speak, they said in the dull tone of shock,
"She let go."
The Ronin winced and straightened, his eyes closed. He wasn't sure whether he owed Koru another prayer. He thought probably he did, but that she wouldn't appreciate it. He held his tongue. Neither spoke as they made their way up the stairs. The Ronin went slowly, and the traveler cajoled him to use their shoulder. It took them a long half hour to reach the top of the stairs. No demon followed, nor harried them on the path. The expanse of the temple courtyard was unpeopled. Some birds flitted here and there, and a corner of the courtyard had been uprooted by a tower of a pine tree. But there was no sign of enemy, shade, or witch. The final stairs were wooden, leading up to the main hall that sat on elaborate stilts so as to best overlook the chasm and the capital beyond. Shinsui's great veranda was also empty. The sun crawled over it through wooden pillars until the light met the painted doors that protected the imposing chamber where the mirror had been held. These were closed. The Ronin looked questioningly to his companion.
"If you're asking me how it went last time...
well, they didn't remember. And yet, you seem content."
"So do you."
The Ronin snorted. He didn't know what he felt. They had fought, and they had suffered losses, and they didn't yet know just how high that tally ran. Concern shadowed his heart, but he could only harbor so much of that when he needed the strength to face what lay beyond that door. He was displaced. He had come to these doors only once before, but he had returned to them time and again in his memory. Often in the early days when he thought of them relentlessly, less so later when he only tripped into the recollection without intention or purpose. Very occasionally, when he dreamed. He indicated that he wanted to sit. He needed to. His bones creaked against exhaustion and cold, and if the door was closed, then they had been granted the reprieve of time. The traveler eased him onto the ground and sat too, at his back. They each had one eye on the door and the other on the veranda. They would be ready for attack from either direction.
I never imagined actually coming back, he confessed. I don't know what to feel.
Quite the admission, coming from you. Ah, or are you hoping I'll finally divulge the last of my secrets? Their air was coy, but brittle. Either way, the Ronin had long since learned that the most effective tactic to take with the Traveler was silence. They seemed faintly annoyed that he remembered this, and they rubbed the arm they had cradled on their return from the bridge. Had they been hurt?
No, not even a bruise.
The Ronin touched his brow to ease a clouding haze. It had been too long since he last slept. The Traveler was speaking. Anyway, I can't imagine you want to hear the woeful tale of a substandard heir. O terrible Dark Lord of the Sith, he that rallied the rebellion against the iniquities of the child-thieving Jedi clans.
Is it wrong to want to better know my ally?
Their silence was strange again. But then, they both understood that they had reached their last opportunity to share anything at all. There would be truth, or there would be nothing.
Can you really call me that? They asked.
Who knows what else I'm keeping from you?
Not you. The Traveler stiffened, then laughed.
Well,
I wouldn't fault a child for their birth.
You might be better off if you did. The words were cold, but their tone was contemplative. I don't want you thinking I had some grand moral objection to my duties. I was fearful, lazy, perhaps because I thought an indolent child would never be trusted to do anything worth noticing. My parents thought Hanrai would turn me around. I suppose he did. It's amazing how grateful you can be for a touch of freedom.
He taught you to kill.
Very quietly, too. And I was so good at it.
Not here.
The witch yet lived, presumably. Everyone hits their limit eventually. The Ronin frowned over his shoulder. He could just make out the curve of their face, oddly still.
You speak of fear as if you overcame it. But you feared him.
Did I? I suppose so. Their look was at once pained and amused by their failure to understand themselves. You called me content here. Maybe I am. I don't know who I was when I came the first time, when I stayed. But I don't think I was afraid. Not until whatever they met had sent them away again. They'd spoken of blood and grief, a catastrophic failure they could not recall. But before that, melancholy, sweetness, laughter, a speck of hope.
And now? I was afraid, the Ronin said. I am.
It felt like a dire mistake to admit it, but the Traveler said nothing, only listened, their back pressed warm to his.
From the moment the Jedi took me in, I don't know that the fear ever left.
He had been afraid of the Jedi, of his place in the galaxy, of the responsibility and the risk. Afraid for himself and his fellows, of what would become of them when they were grown, of how they could never dream to be more than weapons so easily let to die, of how he had come into violence so naturally and well, and yet he was still afraid. What right had he to be? What reason? His body coiled with every recollection.
What are you afraid of now?
Asked the Traveler.
That I shouldn't have come.
In the splinter of the mirror, the witch had said she didn't want him to. Had Hanrai lied? If so,
I don't think I understand why I have.
Well, I did ask you to. Though I suppose my word was never the most convincing argument. Even less so now.
I felt compelled to respond. That doesn't mean I should have.
He had spent so many years thinking he would never seek to return. He had not thought that there was no point in trying because he couldn't.
He had thought, rather, that there was a very good reason why he shouldn't. Yet here he was, present, and permitted to be. One way or another, either he or the witch would die in a matter of hours, minutes, whenever the door next opened. Was that what he had run from all this time? So long as they were apart, both of them could live. The traveler wasn't looking at him as they spoke, but they stood, their arms obscured in front of them. He thought they might be clutching their wrist again. "It seems to me you've spent a long time dreading what you've done wrong, and you haven't spent much of it thinking about what you could do right."
"You suppose I know what right would be?"
"I think you would have to choose." The Ronin frowned, and frowned more deeply when they came around in front of him to meet his look. He wanted to turn away. That meant, in all likelihood, that he shouldn't.
"You choose as wrongly as I have. You lose some right to choose at all."
"Yet here you are, persisting even so."
The traveler's mouth was wry, their eyes tired but soft. They held out their hands to take his and coaxed him up. The Ronin ached, but some of the ache came from disuse. It would be better to stand for a while, at least to stretch.
"Do you know, for a time, I thought it was enough to simply be alive. That I might not owe anyone anything but for my breath to myself. But now..."
The traveler's gaze tracked to the temple door, and it was troubled.
"If we are to be alive, we probably ought to be doing something."
It sounded worthy of being true. Simultaneously, the Ronin didn't like that they thought it was, nor could he imagine allowing it to be true of himself. The Ronin had long since thought himself past the point of doing right, let alone doing good. Not with all the mistakes he had made, and the ones he was still making. But once he had run out of hope for himself, it was so damningly easy to give it up for others, too. That he couldn't abide. Lit by a half-sunk sun, the traveler reached up for his face. Their touch on his cheek was as it had been when they fled the shambles of the Reverend, by turns smooth and calloused. He allowed them to remove his mask, as well as to detach the respirator from his prosthetic. It was unwise, but if they wanted it, then so did he. Foolish though it made him, selfish though he was. Barefaced, the Ronin's breath came short because they were on a mountain, and because he had labored a great deal to get there, and because he was tired, and because he was closer to living intimacy than he had allowed himself to be in many a long, long year. How strange, then, that his chest eased and his breaths lengthened when he saw what the traveler held in their other hand. A familiar lightsaber hilt, yet unlit, that was not theirs, because it was his. He had neither seen nor felt them take it. But then, he'd never known they were cheating until they had already done it. Nevertheless, it felt more correct to see his blade in their hand than to have felt their unguarded closeness so near his mouth. He couldn't put a name to the feeling on their face. The uncertainty on their brow was at odds with the confidence in their grip. He had grown so used to their presence, in current and flare, that he felt the pricking eddies of their disconcertion as if they were his own. They didn't quite understand themselves. That didn't mean they wouldn't act, or that they didn't want to do what they were about to. Though all things given, it seemed unlikely that they did.
"Is this it?"